Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Jenny Dearborn. It is my pleasure to introduce Gretchen Rubin, author of Better Than Before, Mastering the Habits of Our Everyday Lives. Gretchen is one of the most thought-provoking and influential writers on habits and happiness. She graduated from Yale University and Yale Law School, and later clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Her book, The Happiness Project, sold more than 1 million copies and spent more than 2 years on the New York Times bestseller list. She is one of the first LinkedIn influencers and was named as one of the 22 brilliant thinkers everyone should follow on Twitter by Business Insider. Her popular blog is read by millions, and her weekly podcast was named one of the best podcasts of 2015 by iTunes. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Gretchen Rubin.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
So you call habits the invisible architecture of our daily lives. So can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, it's interesting. Research shows that about 40% of everyday life is shaped by our habits. And so if we have habits that work for us, we are much more likely to be happier, healthier, and more productive. And if we have habits that don't work for us, that is just a much bigger challenge. And because habits are freeing and energizing, because they get us out of the business of making decisions and using our self-control, they have a really important role to play in helping us make our life the way we want it to be.
That's great. So unlike most habit formation experts, you emphasize that the most important step in changing a habit is to know yourself. Why is this so important? And how do you go about understanding the self-evaluation process?
Well, I really feel like this is the absolutely key step that so many people ignore, because there are all these kind of magic one-size-fits-all solutions. You know, like, do it first thing in the morning. Start small. Give yourself a cheat day. Do it for 30 days, do what Benjamin Franklin did, and then, you know, all your problems will magically be solved. But that's obviously not true. And so what I found, you know, I identified 21 strategies that people can use to make, that we can use to make or break our habits. But the most important thing is to think about, well, what's true about me? Because I think a lot of times when people, you know, become frustrated because they make the same New Year's resolution year after year, and it's because they've tried to approach a habit in a way that's not right for them. And perfect example is morning people and night people. It's a real thing. And yet over and over, people will say to me, well, my New Year's resolution is to get up early and go for a run every day before work. You know, it's people that I know perfectly well are night people. And it's like, have you met yourself? You're not setting yourself up for success. And the fact that it looks good on paper, I'm a morning person. I get why it makes sense, but it would make sense for someone like me. And so I think when we start by saying, well, what's true about me, then you don't get into this thing like, I'm lazy, I lack self-control. You just think like, I just need to set it up in a way that suits my nature, and that might be very different from other people, even experts who are telling me, well, you should do it this way. Well, no, you should do it whatever way works for you, and there's a lot of strategies that you can use to understand yourself better so that you can shape it to suit you.
Mm-hmm. What did Benjamin Franklin do?
Oh, he did everything. He did a million things. If we could all be like Benjamin Franklin, you know, inventing bifocals, starting a public library, founding a country, you know, like, clearly he's the model we should all be following.
Clearly.
But the fact that it worked for Benjamin Franklin doesn't mean that it works for you, you know. And it's fascinating because if you look at the habits of very, very successful and productive and creative people, what you'll see is that some get up early, and some stay up late, and some drink a lot of booze, and some drink a lot of coffee, and some work in silence and quiet, and some put themselves in the middle of a bunch of people. And so there's no one situation or one setup of habits that guarantees it, but what they all have in common is that they know what works for them, and they are relentless in making their circumstances suit whatever they need. So if it's a person who needs quiet and calm and empty surfaces, they get themselves there. And if they're a person who needs to be in a place with bustle and choice and activity, then they get themselves there. And I think so often we try to say like, well, I'm right and you're wrong. or you're right and I'm wrong. We can both be right for ourselves. And so it's really about starting by understanding what's true for you. Another place this comes up a lot with strong temptation is abstaining or moderating. So abstainers are people who are kind of all or nothing people. And I'm one of these. Like, I can have no cookies or I could have 7 cookies, but I couldn't have 1 cookie. But then there are moderators and they get kind of panicky and rebellious if they're told they can never have something. And so they are the people, you know, that have the bar of fine chocolate that they have tucked away somewhere. And every day or every other day, they have 1 square of fine chocolate. You know, what is up with that? I could never do that. But a lot of times people will say, and I'm an abstainer, and you would not believe what I abstain from, and I love it because it's easier for me to have none. But people will say to me, you're too rigid. It's not healthy to be so hard on yourself. You're setting yourself up for failure. And I say to moderators, why do you keep breaking your own rules? Why don't you just go cold turkey? That's easier. Abstaining is easier, is a strategy that's easy for me, but moderating might be easier for you. And so it's not that one of us is right and one of us is wrong, but that we just have different approaches to a strong temptation.
I think we're both right, because I'm also an abstainer.
Are you an abstainer?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
An abstainer, it's like, you know.
It's so easy.
It's so easy. Oh, and this isn't just food. Technology. My sister had to give up Candy Crush because it was actually interfering with her career.
That's,
you know,
legit.
And
that's
so
real.
Some people just, you can't, if you can't have a little bit, try having none. And it's weird how often none is easier. I get that on paper it sounds harder, but you're with me here.
Mm-hmm.
For people, so how many people here are abstainers? Or clap so that we can hear it on the podcast.
Or just
okay. And yeah, team abstainer, yeah. How many people are moderators? There's a lot of both. Both people are right.
The lights are bright. Maybe it's just redheads that are
abstainers.
How is your book different from other books about habit change? And I should say that the last book I read about habits was 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which seemed like complete opposite of from what you're saying. So maybe if you could contrast that for some people that may have read other things.
Well, I think really what's different about mine is this focus on the individual person and the need to customize for the individual person. And also a lot of times, the people who write about habits will sort of have one idea that they think is kind of like the magic solution for everyone, whereas I try to identify every single thing that a person could possibly use so that you can pick and choose. Now, 21 is a lot, and sometimes people look kind of like overwhelmed and like panicky, like that's too many, just give me 1 or 2. But it means that there's a lot of choices. But so for one good example is the strategy of accountability, which is that if you want someone to follow a habit, hold yourself or someone else accountable. Now, for some people, I argue, this is absolutely crucial. It is the essential thing for them to be able to stick to a habit is outer accountability. But guess what? There's a small number of people for whom accountability is actually counterproductive. The more you look over their shoulder, the more you remind them, the more they will say, you aren't the boss of me, you can't make me, watch me, and ignore the doctor's orders. You know, and so, and you might say, well, okay, it works for a lot of people, and so it is a successful strategy, but if you're thinking about one particular individual, then you want to say, well, what's going to work for this particular individual? So you have to think about all the kind of nuances of, well, what could a person try, and then how could you think about how different personalities might have different responses to different strategies?
But how do you go about finding out, doing the self-reflection to understand what type of person you are? Like, maybe you think, I am that wake up early person, I can do that, but then maybe you're not. Everyone around you sees that you're not, but you don't see it. How do you do that self-evaluation?
Well, I mean, I think that that's a crucial thing, and I think it's one of the great challenges of our lives is to like see ourselves clearly and accept ourselves and understand ourselves, because as you say, like, we're constantly thinking about, well, what should we be, or we assume that we're a certain way, or we think we ought to be a certain way, or we wish we were some way. And so one of the things that I try to do is to highlight a lot of things. And so you can think about yourself in a lot of different ways and often indirectly. So for instance, one good thing to reflect on in terms of a person's habit nature is If you're struggling with a habit, was there a time in the past when you were successful with this habit? Because often people will say things like, oh yeah, when I was in college, I did yoga all the time, but now I don't do it. Okay, well, that tells you something about yourself, because there was something about that situation that worked for you. And so then I try to say, well, what are all the aspects that might have been surrounding that so that you can bring it about? Or maybe you had a really good habit and it's now vanished overnight, right? Because habits are supposed to be so permanent. But then you might have a good habit that vanishes in a flash and you don't know what happened. So to try to get at what might be going on. And so I try to point out a lot of distinctions among people so that you can see how you might be like other people and different from other people.
Mm-hmm. The habit that I hear that most people want to change is eating habits.
Yes, that's certainly huge.
What are some habit-changing strategies you'd recommend for people who are looking to change to better eating habits?
Right. Well, one is the strategy of abstaining, which is what I said before, which is that if you're having trouble having a little bit, try having none. And that might that for a lot of people is easier. Another one of the most powerful strategies, and the one that works for just about everyone, because some of these strategies work for some people but not others, is the strategy of convenience. And then its twin, which is the strategy of inconvenience, which is if you want yourself to do something, make it as easy as possible to do the right thing and to do it as and make it as difficult as possible to do the wrong thing. So for starters, if you don't want people to eat junk food, don't buy it and have it in your house. Because then it's like if somebody wants to eat potato chips, they have to, you know, get in the car and drive and go to get the potato chips. Which, if you are desperate for your potato chips, okay, you could go get them, but it's going to be inconvenient. Or, you know, if it's the ice cream, instead of just having it in the freezer, you, like, tie it in a bag and put it all the way in the back. I know somebody, her strategy, and she said it worked really well, was she had kept her freezer, like, a pretty warm temperature for a freezer, and so when she dug into the ice cream, it would, like, slop in, and she could, like, easily take a bite, you know, these lovely, you know, sloshy bites. And so then she changed her freezer to make it really, really cold. And so she like was like chipping away with a fork to try to get the ice cream out. She said, oh, it's just so much effort, you know? I would just have like a bite or two and then I just like, I can't deal with this, and put it back in. It was just slightly inconvenient. And it's funny, they've done these studies where like, it turns out we're so moved by convenience that if there's a salad bar and there's food that's being served with tongs instead of spoons, people will take less because it's just more work to get it with a tong. Like, that's how. And so if you're, like, let's say you've got a new job and you're thinking, well, you know, I could pay a little bit more and go to a gym that's right across the street, or, you know, I could save, you know, some money over the course of a year if I just went, like, a block out of my way. Well, if you've got the money, go to the one that's right across the street, because it's going to make a big difference. And then inconvenience, you want to make it as inconvenient as possible. You don't want to check your cell phone. You know, don't keep it in the back pocket of your jeans as you're walking around your house. Put it someplace inconvenient so you have to go get it. Another thing about health things is the strategy of other people, because this is a very, very powerful influence on our habits. And so we're always exchanging habits very quickly. I'm affecting your habits, you're affecting my habits. And so basically you want to be very aware of the habits of the people around you. And if they've got good habits, that's going to be helpful to you. If they've got bad habits, that's going to affect you too. And so you want to be very aware of it so you can be controlling your habit and not sliding into it. You know, like you've got a coworker who like every afternoon is like, hey, let's go get a cup of coffee. But then when you go get the cup of coffee, you're always getting a cookie too. You know, you want to say, maybe I'll go get the coffee, but I want to make sure that I'm not adding a cookie every day without even really being aware of it. I'm just sort of going along because it's this, you know, I'm just sort of here. And I'm just imitating what you're doing. I don't have to do that. And then there is one strategy that is the most fun strategy. All the strategies are powerful, but this is the fun that is really a pleasure, which is the strategy of treats. And now, it's not a reward, because a reward is something you have to earn or justify. A treat is something that you get just because you want it. And treats are important because when we give ourselves treats, our self-command rises. And that's something that we really want, is high self-command. But a lot of times we give ourselves unhealthy treats, and food and drink, along with shopping and screen time, you know, are really popular unhealthy treats. And so if you find yourself constantly feeling like, I need it, I deserve it, I should get to have that brownie, I should get to have that extra glass of wine, maybe find a healthy treat to give to yourself so that when you have that feeling of, you know, you're like a cell phone that needs to be plugged into the wall, you can give yourself a healthy treat. You know, maybe you're gonna, like my husband does crossword puzzles on his iPad, or You know, a friend of mine, she has to get her family out the door every morning, and so she gets fully dressed for work, gets them out the door, and then goes back to bed. And she's like, it's the best part of my day. That's a treat. So, you know, if you think about it, I have a special perfume that I keep as a treat. I only wear it when I get in that mode of, like, I need to give myself something and charge my battery. Because when we give more to ourselves, we can ask more from ourselves. So weirdly, by doing something that's fun, you know, going outside and playing with your dog for 20 minutes might make it a lot easier to eat healthfully. And
that's
so that's
great.
And that's a fun strategy.
Why does it matter if you tailor a habit to suit your own nature? Say more about that.
You know, because I just think a lot of times that we just don't set it up in a way that's realistic for ourselves. And so, and then they don't stick because they're not right for us. Another way this comes up is in differences in work pace, habits related to work pace. So some people are marathoners, and I'm a marathoner, which are people who like to start early and work steadily, and they feel like that's what unleashes their creativity and their productivity is doing steady work over time and like letting things, you know, gel. But then some people are sprinters and they really like the adrenaline of the deadline and they like that intensity and they like the crunch. And they feel like that's what unleashes their creativity and productivity. And if they start too early, they tend to kind of burn out or they waste time or they lose interest. And so it's not really helpful for them to start early. But again, this is a thing where like marathoners and sprinters are constantly telling each other that they're doing it wrong. And you can get in trouble at work when you have somebody who's the boss who's saying, ooh, everybody's got to sprint. That's the best way to get the best work. But then you've got marathoners who are miserable. I got an email from a woman who was an associate at a law firm, and she worked for a partner who would constantly set it up so that they were working really intensely right up against a deadline. And she said she finally had to leave the firm because it just made her crazy. But then sprinters, oh my gosh, they're like, why are we starting this now? It's not due for months, you know, and they go crazy. And so again, we can both do our best work if we understand how we might be different from each other, and maybe it's going to be hard to find a compromise, but at least we're not constantly just pointing the finger at each other and saying you're doing it wrong. It's about how can we create a situation, and maybe there are circumstances where that could be beneficial to everybody that people are doing different work at different paces if you think it through. But you really have to have that self-understanding and the insight into how other people might be different. So that you can channel it properly.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like that's also good wisdom for leaders to understand the nature of their teams that they're managing, so that they don't impose their values on a team that has a completely different approach.
No, if you don't understand it, and I think a lot of it is just having a vocabulary so that you can quickly say, you know, I'm an abundance lover, you're a simplicity lover, how do we work this out? Because I think it's just the human instinct is to assume that other people see the world that we do. And we're not even conscious of how we're assuming that other people see the world the way we do. And then when you get an insight into it, then you just can manage the situation so much more easily.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So taking that into sort of extending the work theme about it, so time management is one of the biggest hurdles that people face, and whether they're working at home or in office is something that we're always struggling with. So what is some piece of advice that you would have for people thinking about how to instill new habits to achieve their goals of sort of balancing work life and home life and all of those things? Are there any particular habits that are special for that type of environment versus something else?
Well, one of the strategies that works very well for that is the strategy of scheduling. Because for most people, if something actually appears on their schedule, they're much more likely to stick to it. And so if there's something that's important to you, you should actually put it on the calendar. So let's say you have a lot of short-term, you know, this is the classic problem of the urgent driving out the important. So if you feel like that's happening to you, you could say like, okay, well, I'm gonna set aside 2 hours every morning where I'm gonna work on my annual report, which isn't due for months, but I really know that to do a good job, because you're a marathoner or whatever, you know, and so I'm going to put that on my calendar and really set aside specific time for that. Now, and it can be for anything that you think is important. So you might say to yourself, well, I'm going to set aside time every evening to read a novel, and I'm only going to do that at that time. And for most people, that's really powerful because it eliminates kind of the need to make a decision. You know, you might go through your whole day saying, oh yeah, well, I really want to get to that. But then, you know, one thing leads to another and it never happens. But if it's on your schedule. And also the thing about scheduling that's useful is it forces you to make choices. Because if you just have a vague sense of everything that's important in your life, then it's just like, well, I should just do everything. Well, if you put it in a calendar, you say, well, there isn't time for everything. And so I have to make choices and trade-offs. Because sometimes we have to choose between things because we just don't have enough time. So that's a good way. And then also the strategy of inconvenience. I mean, if you don't want yourself to check your cell phone, put it in your briefcase, put it on the top shelf of your closet, and shut the door. Like, you're just not going to check it every 10 minutes because it's going to be too much of a pain. Or somebody said to me, like, oh, I really need to work on my self-control because I text while I drive. And I really need to work on my willpower on that. And I was like, don't worry about your willpower, man. What you do is you put your phone on silent and put it under this, you know, put it in the back seat behind you so you can't reach it. And he was like, yeah, I don't know if that's going to work. I'm like, of course it's going to work. You know, I'm like, don't put it in the glove compartment. That you're going to get that thing out at a red light for sure. I can see it in your eyes. Put it in the backseat. Put it in the trunk. You know, don't rely on your self-control. Make it so inconvenient that you can't do something, you know, and then it can
And
really
by the
help.
Way, what's your license plate number?
Seriously. Yeah. I know. He confessed to it. You know, and then there's the strategy of foundation, which is there are certain areas of life that really we need to think about with particular emphasis because they go directly to our ability to manage ourselves. And those are, and most of these are not a surprise, getting enough sleep, eating and drinking properly, so that's like not letting yourself get too hungry, because a lot of times people... they get, you know, you skip breakfast, you skip lunch, and then you eat all the wrong food, and you're like... hangry, you know, irritable, high strung and everything because you're just hungry. So eating and drinking. Exercise is like the magical elixir of life. It calms us and energizes us. It helps people think more clearly, manage their moods. And then weirdly, clutter. This was a surprising thing when I was thinking about foundation. But for many people, outer order contributes to inner calm and makes them feel more in command of themselves. And, you know, often, when I feel like everything's spiraling out of control, if I just take like a half an hour and clean out my office, I just feel this sense of calm and energy. And it's clearly a trivial thing to have a bunch of dirty coffee cups lying around and your coat's not hung up. But there's something about getting control over the stuff of life, I think, that makes us feel more in control of ourselves generally.
What's the most surprising thing you found in your research? Any fun stories that you found?
Well, I think the most surprising thing that I found was this four tendencies framework mm-hmm. that I came up with. And this is a personality framework. And I was surprised because I didn't realize that there was this pattern of human behavior. I thought I was pretty typical, which, by the way, I am not. I'm on the freaky fringe. No one was surprised but me. And so the four tendencies, and it has a lot of implication for habits and for a lot of different things. And so this is whether people are upholders, questioners, obligers, or rebels. And it has to do with how a person responds to an expectation. So there are outer expectations, like a work deadline, inner expectations, like your own desire to keep a New Year's resolution. And what was astonishing to me was that once I identified these four categories, how consistently people would fall into a category and how they would say so many of the same things, like almost even little weird things that seem totally idiosyncratic. So the first, upholders, are people who readily meet outer and inner expectations. So they meet a work deadline, they keep a New Year's resolution without much fuss. And that's my tendency, I'm an upholder. Next are questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. So they hate anything arbitrary or rational. So they make everything an inner expectation because they want to know, like, they have to endorse it in order to follow along. And their first question is, why am I listening to you anyway? And the next is obliger. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. So that's, you know, the person who will never let down the team, never misses a deadline at work, but then can't go to the gym regularly. And then finally, rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. So they want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. If you ask or tell them to do something, they are very likely to resist. And what has just been astonishing to me is how consistently people will say things and respond to things in a way that is consistent with their tendency.
Very cool.
Oh, and there's a quiz on my site, GretchenRubin.com, if you want to take a quiz. A lot of times people, like, in a flash recognize themselves. But if you want to take a quiz that will tell you what you are, you can take the quiz online.
Would it make, about the quiz, would it make sense for a group of people to take the quiz so that they can sort of get to know each other better?
Yeah, no,
like,
absolutely.
I'm this, you're that, now I know how to talk to you, kind of thing.
I hear about it all the time that people at work will take it together, and strangely, over the holidays, it turned out that a lot of families took it together and, like, all talked about it. And I got these hilarious emails from people. It's like, we're a family of all upholders. And I'm like, I can't even visualize that. This is what we found, or like, oh, you know, she brought home a rebel, he brought home a rebel girlfriend, and like, what do we do? And so it's very funny, but it's very helpful in teams, because, like, for instance, questioners, one of the problems with questioners is they're always asking questions, and so sometimes they're perceived as being uncooperative or undermining to a boss or not being a team player. And a lot of people have said to me, like, oh, well, now that I understand that people are questioners, they don't mean it to be an attack or to be, like, questioning my judgment. They just need to understand my reasons in order to get with the program. And so now I just understand that, like, I might feel like I've answered people's questions sufficiently, but for some questioners, they really need to have quite a lot of questions answered. And maybe at a certain point I'm going to say, I'm not going to answer any more questions. But understanding that it's not coming from a place of being lacking, like, team spirit, it's just that that's how they get to where they need to go in order to be consistently, you know, performing.
And questioning also doesn't come across as a criticism, in case my husband's listening. So yeah. I just want to know. I'm not trying to be critical.
Right, right. And if you're thinking to yourself, I question the validity of this framework, that's a big sign that you're a questioner.
So you've talked to a lot of people about the habits they want to change. What are the habits that you hear people want to tackle most?
Well, you've mentioned a couple of them. One is eating healthfully. Another is managing time, like having time to rest and relax and enjoy things, like not feeling hounded by work, being able to get off your cell phone, that kind of thing. Another one is engaging more deeply with relationships, like wanting to have, you know, whether that's calling your parents or seeing your friends or taking time to read to your children at night, having those kinds of habits. Certainly exercise is a big one. One's related to saving, spending, earning wisely. So that might be like, I need to do more networking. I need to, how do I consistently work on this career shift that I want to make? I need to learn something for my job, but like, I'm supposed to do it in my free time and I never get around to it. How do I do that? One is battling procrastination. I want to make consistent progress. I want to get back. I want to learn Italian. I want to learn to play guitar. I want to do yoga. I want to start meditating. Like, how do I get in consistent progress? And then another one is this related to this clutter idea, like people wanting to stay in habits that they keep things orderly and neat and sort of keep their environments organized. So those are some of the big ones that kind of come up over and over, and mm-hmm. people have different takes on them, but those are the big areas.
Okay, cool. A question from the audience. You suggest daily habits as a way to improve. Does this mean that all the books about making quantum leaps in your life really don't work, that it really is more incremental?
That's a great question, because this is a good example of how some things, like some people do better one way and some people do better another way. It isn't like there's one answer, you know, that everyone should follow. Some people like to take small steps. They like small accomplishments. They like to build up. They like to, you know, it's like, I'm going to write one sentence every day so I get in the habit of sitting down at my desk. And then I'm going to work up to two sentences, and then I'm going to work up to three sentences. For some people, that is a great approach. Other people get very bored. They're not interested in incremental change. That loses their interest and they fade away. And so this is a question, like you were saying, how do you know yourself? You have to think about yourself. What appeals to me? What can I envision myself sticking to? When have I succeeded in the past? What has worked for me? And so not to think like, well, if I just read the right article, it's going to tell me exactly what to do. It's more like, okay, how is this going to work for me? Do I want to do something big and bold? Do I want to do something manageable and small? Both can work.
Gotcha. Okay. Another question from the audience. Are you still following a low-carb diet?
Oh,
if not, what diet are you following? It sounds like you've shared your dieting in the past.
Yeah, well, my sister is here, and she's going to be like, oh, my gosh. She's still following a low-carb diet. I write in the book about the strategy of the lightning bolt. And this is a strategy that's somewhat frustrating because it's incredibly powerful in that it can change a massive habit overnight. But it's not something that we can invoke. It's really something that comes to us from the outside. And so you're hit with a new idea or realization, and as a consequence, your habits just change in a flash. And this happened to me when I read a book called Why We Get Fat by Gary Tobbs, where he argues about why it's healthier, in his judgment, and he explains why, to eat a very low-carb diet. And overnight, I changed everything the way that I eat, like no small steps, no gradual substitutions, just overnight. I do indeed eat a very low carb diet, and I love it. And I have a tremendous sweet tooth, and I am an abstainer. And so by totally abstaining from sugar, I am completely free from all the noise of sweets, which is, you know, somebody said, but doesn't it make you sad not to eat a brownie? And I'm like, not eating a brownie makes me so much happier than eating a brownie ever made me. That's what works for me, but this is not something that would work for everyone. You know, this is why I changed. This is what works for me, but I would not say that everyone should do it. But what's interesting about the lightning bolt is when it happens, if it's a positive change, you really want to support it. I think sometimes people don't even believe their eyes. They're like, well, it's not possible to change something as ubiquitous as eating habits overnight. This must not be real. But it's like, it can be real. People really do have lightning bolt changes, which can persist if you just think about how you might support the habit once it gets going.
Cool. Does your research mention a maximum number of habits one should tackle at a time to be successful?
Okay, same thing, right? What am I going to say? There is no magic answer. Some people like to do a lot all at once. My college roommate, her motto was, do everything all at once. And it was a great motto for her. And then some people's motto is do one thing at a time, and that can work really well too. And it might even be that for the same person at a different time or with a different set of habits, one might work better than the other. And so I think that it's helpful to get away from the idea of thinking that there's like a magic solution that if it could be identified would solve the problem, to thinking about who am I and how can I set this up in a way that's going to work for me.
Okay, cool. Another question from the audience. How did you figure out all of the details for the four tendencies, as in how did you gather the description for each type?
Well, it was very hard. I mean, I have to say, of every kind of intellectual challenge I've ever had to grapple with in my life, this was definitely the hardest, because I started to see these patterns emerging from the way people would respond. So like if I said to somebody, a question that I started to ask people is, how do you feel about New Year's resolutions? One thing that people would say is, I don't do New Year's resolutions because January 1st is an arbitrary date. And they use that word, arbitrary. And that really struck me, because I can imagine many reasons not to do New Year's resolutions, but the arbitrariness of the date January 1st did not trouble me. But clearly, all these people, it's like the CIA had beamed the same answer into them, because they were answering verbatim. Then there was this pattern. Another thing that I noticed, because with the Happiness Project and Happier Tom, I was always writing about happiness and all the things that I did in order to try to make myself happier. And over, people would say to me, but how did you get yourself to do those things? And I was like, well, I just thought that they would make me happier, so I did them. And they would say, but how did you get yourself to do them? And I thought, you know, there's something different about me. I don't understand what they're saying. Like, what is the thing? What's going on here? I'm different from them. How am I different from them? So I began to get a sense of, well, there does seem to be something different about me. And then I had this crazy conversation, which was so helpful. I was at a cocktail party, and I was talking to a woman who I now realize is a rebel. At the time, I didn't know. I hadn't identified the tendencies. And we were talking about habits, and because I am a habits bore, I will talk about everybody with their habits relentlessly. And I said to her, and we were talking about it, and I said to her, well, discipline is my freedom. And she said, that doesn't make sense, because freedom means no rules. And I was like, woohoo! We see the world in a totally different way. And so as these patterns started emerging, why is it that we can't take time for ourselves? I don't have any trouble taking time for myself. What's going on with you? How's that different? People who, would just sort of like question, like they would not be doing something, and then just in a flash they'd be like, makes sense after all, and then they'd follow it. So it was slowly seeing these patterns. But I have to say, when I finally saw the four categories and how they are perfectly symmetrical with inner and outer expectations, because I had this feeling like being a Victorian explorer discovering the Nile or something, you know, because it just felt so right to me. I felt like I was discovering something in nature.
What is the difference between happiness and joy?
You know, I started out as a lawyer, and I spent a semester arguing about the definition of contract, and ever since then, I don't really define terms. And I feel like one of the things I like about the term happiness is that it's a big enough, loose enough concept that it can encompass joy if somebody wants it to be joy. Or it can be contentment or satisfaction or peace or bliss. Or, and academics have like 17 definitions of happiness. So I think for each person to decide for themselves is helpful, because it's also like the goal is to be happier, not to achieve some magic utopia cross, finish line. So I don't really have an answer for that one.
Okay. What is the difference or the connection between habits and willpower?
That is the crucial question. That like absolutely goes to the heart, the beating heart of why we should care about habits, right? Because we're all busy. Why worry about your habits? So habits free us from using willpower, because willpower is draining and difficult. And it's often not successful, right? Because you can spend the entire day. Should I go to the gym? I mean, I went yesterday, and I'm definitely going tomorrow. And it might hurt your feelings if I don't go to the staff meeting. And what's one time going to the gym anyway going to do for me? And, it's raining. So then you're using your willpower. You're trying to decide. You're trying to, like, force yourself to do something. But the thing about a habit is you don't have to use your willpower, because you're up and you're at the gym before you even know what happened. You know, you're not debating what to do or what course to take. You know, it's like you don't use your willpower to use your seatbelt or to brush your teeth. You don't decide every time. You don't use your willpower to do that. It just happens automatically. And the brain wants to make behavior into a habit, because then the brain is free to think about novel or urgent or complex matters. It doesn't have to worry about these habits. And so the habits are like, and they did this fascinating research where they were looked at people who were doing very well, and what they expected to see was these people would be using, they would have a lot of willpower and they'd be using a lot of willpower. But what they found to their surprise was they weren't using a lot of willpower. How could that be? And what they found was that these people had put all these behaviors into habits. So they weren't using willpower to go to the gym or to eat healthfully or whatever. That was all running on habits. It was just on automatic. And so then they had a lot of reserves of willpower when they needed it, because they didn't have to use it that much. So habits, willpower is so precious. We don't want to use it if we don't have to. We want to save it for what we really need, and habits can allow us to do that.
What is the role of parents in instilling good habits in their kids?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of the way we are is genetically determined, you know. And so sometimes you get a kid who's just really neat and orderly, because that's their nature. They want to be neat and orderly. It doesn't matter what you do, and the opposite. But one of the things as I mentioned before, the strategy of other people is very powerful. And so if you want your children to have a certain kind of habit, you definitely want to have that habit yourself. So if you want your children to eat a healthy breakfast, don't race out of the house every morning just having a cup of black coffee, because then you're not showing them, like, this is how we do things. Because a lot of times we pick up habits just from being around people. We just share them back and forth. And I think parents can obviously play a very, very important role. But I do think we also have to recognize that sometimes, you know, you get what you get and you don't get upset. You know, they're not totally malleable. And so you need to pick your battles too when you're talking about what habits to do. But here's the thing is, like, if you know the tendency of your child, you can do a lot better job with their habits. For instance, if you have a questioner child and a questioner child says something like, you know, why do I have to do this homework? It's not teaching me anything. The worst thing you could say is like, well, you have to do it because your teacher says so. Because they'll be like, yeah, well, it doesn't make any sense. I'm not going to do it. It's an inefficient use of my time. Like, the teacher's a chucklehead. Why am I doing this? I'm not going to. But if you really sit down and you say, well, you know, you might think that this is a waste of time, but this is really teaching you how to learn. It's teaching you how to handle complex ideas. It's teaching you how to paraphrase things in your own words. These are really important skills. Then the questioner child can be like, okay, I understand why this homework is a good use of my time, and I'll do it. So then they can stick to it. I had a friend who had a rebel child who wanted to play violin, and they were paying for violin lessons, but she kept reminding the child to practice, and the child didn't. And I said to her, I was like, man, you got a rebel child there. Don't keep telling him to practice, because then he's got to resist you and say, you're not the boss of me. I'm not going to practice violin if you tell me to. You should just say to him, lay out the facts and let him be the judge. That's what works for rebel children. So say something like, you really want to play the violin, and your teacher says that if you want to learn how to play, it's really important to practice because that's the only way that you get the skills. I'm willing to pay for the lessons if you feel like you're going to be learning. But if you're not going to be learning, then and you don't want to practice, then I don't think that we'll spend the money on the lessons. That's just the facts. That's just the facts of it. If you want to play violin, you got to practice. If nothing's happening, I'm not going to pay for it. And she just backed away and like stopped reminding her child. And then he practiced because he was like, yeah, this works for me. I want to learn how to play violin, so I'm going to practice. But by nagging him and pestering him, she was just igniting that spirit of opposition. And so by understanding how people think about things, a lot of times we can shape the circumstances in a way that respects their perspective.
Mm-hmm. Many people are interested in helping others.
Yes.
In reforming their bad habits.
Yes. That's more fun. Definitely more fun.
Because we're perfect, really.
Yeah,
it's other people.
Yeah, definitely more fun.
You know, a coach, a parent, a teacher or something. So what piece of advice would you give for others who want to help? They want to help the people around them with the bad habits that they observe.
Well,
in
this
other
is that is an absolute crucial question, because there's so much. I mean, just in healthcare alone, like if we could cure people of their bad habits, like what good could we do in the world? And I think a big part of it again is like recognizing that just because something works for you doesn't mean that it necessarily works for someone else, and really respecting that and watching out for those differences. For instance, I will say, in my observation, most nutritionists are moderators. They have a healthy, easy relationship with food, and they think if everybody ate the way they did, they would also have a healthy, easy relationship with food. And I can't tell you how many nutritionists tell me, like, you're doing it wrong, that's the wrong way to eat. And I'm like, it works for me, you know? And same thing with the teacher. If you can understand how people are different, like with the questioner, well, I need to spend a little time with this kid explaining, like, why are we doing this? Because that's what they need to get on board. And another thing, you know, some people, obligers, for obligers to meet an inner expectation, they must have external accountability. That is the answer for obligers. So when obligers are frustrated because they can't meet their expectations for themselves, you plug in the outer accountability. But often people don't understand that, and they say they don't want to act as outer accountability. So for instance, a thing that happens a lot with writers is you'll have a writer who's very prolific and productive. When they're working on a newspaper or magazine because they've got deadlines and editors, and then they go on book leave, and they've got a year to write a book. Nobody's checking on them. Like a deadline, distant in the distant haze, and they stall out. And I had a friend who said to her editor, "I need deadlines. Convince me that they're real and make me do it, or I'm not going to write this book." And the editor didn't understand how crucial it was that he play that role and provide that accountability, or help her get accountability of a different kind, like work with a coach, join an accountability group, whatever. And he's like, "Oh no, no, take your time. It's going to be great. You're a genius." So she wrote the whole thing in 3 weeks. But she was telling him, "I need accountability." And so for some people, it's really important that you play that role. And so you might, or I was talking to somebody who was supervised PhD students. And he's like, oh yeah, you know, they're so bad about working on their papers and I'm supposed to meet with them once a week, but they're not making progress. So I'm like, I'm not gonna meet with you until you have progress. I'm like, don't do that. That's the worst thing you could do. Tell them that they have to have something to show you when they meet with you, or you know, and you wanna see it every week. Like, what have they added? Really make them feel that accountability, and that's what's gonna help them step up because they need it.
You have a popular podcast called Happier with Gretchen Rubin, which you do with your sister, Elizabeth Kraft. What brought you to creating that podcast, and what are some fun things that came out of it for the two of you?
Oh my gosh, it's so much fun. Elizabeth is here with me tonight.
Very cool.
Hi. Yes, yay, Elizabeth. Because with her new haircut, if you listen to the podcast, you know all about her haircut. Because tomorrow is our first live event, and so at the Brava Theater in San Francisco, so we're very excited about that. And you know, the podcast has been so exciting because it's what I found. So I came out of traditional book writing, and then I had a blog, and then I had video. And what I found is that with every way that you connect with people, you know, different people like to take in information in different ways. And some people really want video, and some people really want audio, and some people really want text, and some people really want images. And so everything that I do, I find that I can connect with an audience in a different way. And the podcast has been great because it's this super powerful, interesting medium that's just starting out, you know, so it's very exciting. It's a great way to connect, and it's a great sort of community to be in, to be one, to be among the podcasters. It's a whole new identity. And so it's been really thrilling to have a chance to take these ideas into a different forum.
Yeah, good luck with the live broadcast.
Yes.
Tomorrow. It's going to be a total blast.
Yes.
Here's a silly question. What is Oprah really like in person?
Oh my gosh. Exactly like what you would think, like larger than life.
So cool.
Yes, no, she was, and it's funny because I talked to a couple of people, friends of mine who had done interviews with her before to sort of like tell me, you know, like what to think about. And one of the things is if you're interviewed a lot, you get good at like knowing how, if you have to take control, if you're talking to somebody and you need to steer it, or, you know, you have to be very kind of conscious of that. And what they both said the same thing, and they're like, don't do that. She is the master. Put yourself into her hands and let her just be in control of the whole thing. And I have to say, it was, I mean, afterward, I was like, I literally do not remember one thing we talked about. It was like, when the thing aired, I was like, oh yeah, I remember that now. You know, it was like this weird out-of-body experience, because she is just such this overpowering personality. And you know, and I don't know about you, but when I see famous people in real life, you just sort of want to giggle because they look so much like themselves. It's like,
you look just like you.
Yeah, it's like, it's sort of like seeing Madame Tussauds waxworks come to life or something like that. She looked like kind of a, you know, and so it was a really fantastic experience to get
That's
to do
very
that.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
How do you measure and quantify habits? You know, if for people who are looking for like a metric or some sort of measurement system, is there something that you would recommend for that type of person?
Well, that's the strategy of monitoring, which is a very powerful strategy as well. One of the most powerful strategies, which is that anything that you want to manage, you should measure. And one of the things that's sort of magical about monitoring is that often when we monitor something, we tend to do a better job of it, even if we're not consciously trying to change. So if you, and you know the classic examples, we all know them. If you keep a food journal, you do a better, you eat more healthfully. If you use an app to like track all of your spending, you're gonna spend more wisely. And so with any habit that you wanna do, when you're trying to get it to like sort of set into concrete, just monitoring how much you do it tends to help you. And then for many people, the don't break the chain is a very appealing approach as well, which is you really try to be like, see one day after the other after the other. There's sort of like, it's sort of an excitement of like, you know, seeing your streak. And so monitoring can be really helpful.
That's
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Now, if you're a rebel, no.
Okay. No. Step one, know yourself.
Yeah, know yourself.
Right.
Because that kind of thing makes them crazy. Because they want to choose to do something. And, you know, but if they chose to monitor, then they could do it and they would want to do it.
Do you have a sense from your research what percentage of the population falls into
yes,
the four quadrants?
Absolutely. It's very consistent. The smallest group is rebel. It's a conspicuous tendency, but it's a small tendency. Slightly larger is upholder, and I'm an upholder, and I was amazed when I realized like how small the upholder tendency is. There aren't that many people who are upholders, and those are the sort of two poles. Overwhelmingly, people are questioners or obligers, and I think obliger is the slightly larger tendency, but those are the two they are the two dominant tendencies.
And did you see any pattern in male, female,
no.
age, wise, socioeconomic, nothing?
No, I think these are hardwired, pervasive. We come into the world with them, and mm-hmm. rarely do they change.
Mm-hmm. What's the best piece of advice you'd offer for someone who feels like they've tried absolutely everything? Like, what is that one takeaway? Magic something.
Know yourself.
People keep sending in letters like, no, really.
Yeah,
tell
no,
me
no,
what
no,
to
right,
do.
Right, right.
No,
right.
no, really.
No, I mean, everybody wants the, if you would just eat one bowl of oatmeal at 10 a.m. every single day, your problems will be solved. You know, and I mean, you can find a million people who will tell you, like, you know, variations of that.
People are tweeting now about the oatmeal.
That's the other
thing. She said oatmeal.
Yeah. Like, that's the takeaway, right? I mean, and I get it. Like, you just feel like, well, if somebody would just sort of hand me the magic template, it would, you know, and you see other people, you know, doing it. But really, it just, that's over and over and over when I talk to people who have struggled, and then when I talk to people that have had a success, it's because they've taken the time to say, okay, well, you know, I'm an early morning person. I'm an obliger. I like the outdoors, you know, and you're like, okay, well, you want to have the habit of exercise. What's going to work for you? Okay, I'm going to make, you know, a date with my neighbor that we're going to go for a walk every morning from 7:30 to 8 a.m. outside. Okay, and that appeals to that person. Where for another person, that would like be like the worst penalty imaginable. You know, I don't want to be with somebody else. You know, I don't want to be outside. I don't like weather. I'm a night person, not a morning person. You know, and so I think you really do just have to take yourself into account. And I think there's hope for people, even people who feel very kind of hopeless about a habit that they've struggled with over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Your book, The Happiness Project, sold more than a million copies, spent 2 years on the New York Times bestseller list. How did that change your perspective of habits or willpower or happiness? How did that change you as a person, that experience?
Well, you know, really the experience of a book is much more about the writing of it, you know, and so certainly writing The Happiness Project had enormous consequences for me. And it was thrilling that it connected with so many people, because I have to say, when I was writing the book, I worried, and I got to say a lot of other people worried too, and they would tell me this when I would tell them what I was writing about. They either told me that I was so idiosyncratic that no one could identify with me, or that I was so boring that no one could identify with me. I was like, I'm either extremely unusual or totally average. I don't know which one. And so it was really exciting to realize like that the kind of things that I was thinking about or going through were things that other people found interesting and identified with. So that was certainly exciting. And then to go deeper into the subject with Happier at Home, and then over time to realize the role that habits play in allowing us to build happier, healthier, more productive lives. So it's all kind of been linked, but really my subject since I started writing has always been human nature. And like I wrote biographies of JFK and Churchill, and those are sort of such giant characters that you can see them more clearly. And so for me, this was all part of that kind of trying to understand human nature more and more deeply.
So what is the connection of all the different pieces of your research that you've had? Is it sort of the story arc of all of your books? So you started with happiness, and that led you to...
No. I started with a book called Power, Money, Fame, Sex, A User's Guide. Yeah. It's like the opposite of The Happiness Project. But that was a fun book to write. Oh my God. You know, every book I write, I think, you know what? It's never going to get as good as this again. You will never enjoy any book as much as this one again. So this one is the best. And then I get the next one. I'm like, oh no, this one is the best. So I'm very, so I love all my books. I loved writing them. No, so it was Power, Money, Fame, Sex, and then Churchill. than JFK. Then I wrote this weird book with an artist called Profane Waste, which is why do people destroy their own possessions, which if you look at sort of classical legal theory about possessions doesn't really make sense. And yet I would, everywhere I looked, I saw examples of people deliberately destroying their own possessions, a subject that still haunts me. And then that led me to, and then I got into the happiness, and then happiness, and then that sort of like, that turned out to be such a rich, fascinating area that I've stayed in it since.
Yeah, it's the progression of how one subject sort of tips off your thinking and your research to another subject.
Yes. No, because in Power, Money, Fame, Sex, I became very interested in Churchill because he is just this, you know, extraordinary figure. And if you're studying power, you just inevitably led to a study of him. And he, I, you know, once I started, I could not stop reading about him and thinking about him. And then, and so, yeah, so they've all sort of, one leads to the other.
That's great. So we've reached the time in our program where we have just time for one more question. What patterns did you see in the book Daily Rituals? Question from our audience.
Well, I love the work. I love the book Daily Rituals by Mason Curry. I highly recommend it. And what it is I think it's 161, like two-page profiles of like creative people, scientists, philosophers, artists, poets, architects, looking at their habits. And as, what do you see? Do they all get up and do, like, get up at 7 a.m. and go for a run and then work at their desk for 2 hours on their high priority things, like in silence, and then they go out and, you know, no, they do all kinds of different things. If you look at these things, you see the most tremendous range. Gertrude Stein works for half an hour a day, you know, and then, like, was it like P.G. Wodehouse works for, like, 17 hours a day, or I can't remember who that was, but I mean, you just see this incredible range of, the circumstances in which they are creative, their work pace, the people that they hung out with, the environment, you know, some were in, wanted to be in the country, some were in the city. And again, all it does is show is there is no magic one-size-fits-all solution. You know, it's not like the seven habits of highly creative people. And if you just follow those seven habits, you will be highly creative too. Because those highly creative people might be very different from you. And trying to imitate them, you could get ideas, you might, like, your own thoughts could be provoked, you might find something interesting, but the idea that if you just plug them into your own life, that you will succeed. No, and I think that Mason Curry's book, which I highly recommend, it's fascinating, is an excellent illustration of how there's so many different ways to be happy, healthy, and productive, but we really have to pick the way that's right for us. And that's when we can succeed.
Okay, great. All right. Well, I thank you. Any closing thoughts?
No. Well, thank you so much for. I'm so happy to be here. I
So I hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Gretchen Rubin, author of Better Than Before, Mastering the Habits of Our Everyday Lives, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.